We're talking about King Records, one of the most important independent labels of the 1950s. It launched James Brown's career and recorded a mix of country, blues, and rhythm and blues performers, including the Stanley Brothers, the Delmore Brothers, Lonnie Johnson, Hank Ballard, and Earl Bostick. My guest, John Fox, is the author of a new book about the Cincinnati-based label called King of the Queen City. John Fox, welcome to Fresh Air. You describe King Records as helping to integrate America through music. So what do you mean by that?
Well, King, pretty much from the very beginning of the company in the mid-1940s, had a relatively colorblind approach to music. Sid Nathan, the founder of the label, always said that he made music for the little man. And he felt that he was an outsider to mainstream society, so he was very conscious of trying to satisfy the musical consumers that the major record labels weren't doing. One of the things that he found out doing that was that black and white music, which was kept pretty segregated by record companies and record stores and consumers, was essentially the same thing. If you peel it back one label, country music and blues and rhythm and blues was essentially the same thing. Once he realized that, he began to encourage country artists to record blues and rhythm and blues songs to which he held the copyrights, and vice versa, blues and rhythm and blues artists record country songs. So that was one way that he helped to break down a barrier. More important way was that King had probably the first integrated staff of any record company in the country, primarily through the hiring of Henry Glover in the mid-1940s. Henry was a black musician, songwriter, record producer, arranger. And in the early years of King, he was essentially the number two man, second only to Sid Nathan. And Henry produced the blues and rhythm and blues that he might have been expected to, but he also produced a lot of country recordings.
Now, you mentioned that what Sid Nathan, the founder of King Records, would do, since he had rhythm and blues artists and country musicians signed to the label, he would take songs that he held the copyright to and have both a rhythm and blues performer and a country group record it. And I want to play an example of that. And this was this is Hank Ballard doing Finger Poppin' Time, which was a pretty big hit for him, and then a Stanley Brothers version of the same song. I'm assuming the Hank Ballard came first.
Yes. Yes, it did. It's a Hank Ballard original.
He wrote it?
Yes.
Okay. So do I have anything to say? Do you have anything to say about this pairing before we hear it?
It's one of my favorite Stanley Brothers songs. It's kind of an odd duck in their catalog. They were among the most traditional bluegrass artists of the time, but they also hadn't had a hit in a long time, and bluegrass was kind of on life support in the late 50s and early 60s when they were making these records for King. Sid Nathan asked them to do this song, and they really had no reason to refuse him, so they did it.
Okay, so here's Hank Ballard, followed by the Stanley Brothers, doing the Hank Ballard song, Finger Poppin' Time.
Hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now, it's finger poppin' time. Finger poppin', poppin' time. I feel so good. Woo! And that's a real good sign. Real good sign.
We just heard the Stanley Brothers version of Finger Pop in Time, which was originated by Hank Ballard, whose version we first heard. They were both recorded in 1960, both for King Records. And one of the things King Records specialized in was having country and rhythm and blues artists on the same label. My guest, John Hartley Fox, has just written a new book about that record label, which is called King of the Queen City. Well, it's really fun to hear those back to back. Now, another record that you write about in your book about King Records is the song Good Rockin' Tonight, originally recorded by Wynonie Harris in 1948. You make the case that this King record was actually the first rock and roll record. And as you concede, many people would make the case that Ike Turner's Rocket 88 was really the first rock and roll record that came a few years later. Why do you consider Wynonie Harris's Good Rockin' Tonight the first rock and roll record?
That was kind of a goofball claim I made in the book, because it's obviously something that is open to endless debate. But it had the right attitude, and the key was it crossed over to white record buyers. Not as much as later King records in the early 50s did, but this was one of the first, I think, that was heard by white teenagers in fairly large numbers. Evidence of that is Elvis Presley. This was one of Elvis's favorite songs and one of the first ones he recorded.
Is there a story behind how Wynonie Harris ended up recording this for King?
Yeah, the song was written by Roy Brown, who recorded for Deluxe, which was a King subsidiary after a while. And Roy wrote this song and approached Wynonie Harris at one of Wynonie's gigs and tried to sell him the song for, I believe, $50. And Wynonie blew Roy Brown off. So Roy was broke. He needed some money. So he recorded it himself for Deluxe Records. A man named Cecil Gant, a singer who had had success on Deluxe, intervened for him with the Braun Brothers, who owned the label, and got Roy a quick contract on Deluxe. He recorded the song and was beginning to have a hit with it. It was certainly a regional hit down around New Orleans and working its way cross country. When Wynonie Harris saw that Roy was beginning to have a hit with the song, he remembered blowing it off and realized his mistake. So he hustled into the King Studios in Cincinnati and cut pretty much an exact copy of Roy Brown's version. But because of King's far superior distribution and marketing, Wynonie got the hit on the record. So he made an initial mistake, but he corrected it.
We'll talk more about King Records and hear more music in the second half of the show. John Fox is the author of King of the Queen City, The Story of King Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Fox, the author of the new book, King of the Queen City, The Story of King Records. The Cincinnati-based label was founded in 1943 by Sid Nathan, who ran it until 1971. King recorded country, blues, and rhythm and blues, launched the career of James Brown, and released the original versions of Fever, The Twist, and Good Rockin' Tonight. Now, King Records also had a reputation for recording some songs with sexual overtones or double entendres. One of the big examples would be the Domino's recording of 60 Minute Man. So were there problems with either radio stations not wanting to play it or parental negative reaction? Like, what was the response to these sexual innuendo kind of songs?
Well, those songs were pretty universally banned from radio airplay, and were condemned from every pulpit, public and secular. But kids loved it. Sid Nathan was not the first to find that controversy doesn't hurt record sales in the slightest. And this was one of the first big crossovers, and I think that white kids bought by the thousands. And I think that was the real reason for the controversy, was it came really to the first time of the attention of a lot of moral arbiters of the country.
So from the early 1950s, here's the Domino's recording of 60 Minute Man.
call me love and dad. I'll rock 'em, roll 'em all night long. I'm a 60-minute man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you don't believe I'm all I say, come up and take my hand. When I let you go, you'll cry. Oh yes, he's a 60-minute man. There'll be 15 minutes of kissing. Then you holler, please don't stop.
Don't stop.
There'll be 50 minutes teasing and 50 minutes squeezing and 50 minutes of blowing my top.
That's the Domino's recording of 60 Minute Man on the King record label. And the King label is the subject of the new book, King of the Queen City being Cincinnati. My guest is the author of the book, John Hartley Fox. Of all the performers signed by King, probably the most successful, the most famous, the most groundbreaking was James Brown. How did King Records end up signing James Brown?
Ralph Bass was a producer and talent scout for King Records. He ran Federal Records, which was one of their subsidiaries. And he, for most of each year, traveled the country looking for talent. He ran across a demo tape of James Brown at an Atlanta radio station, found that they were in Macon, went there, finally made connection with a mover and shaker named Clint Brantley, and then went to hear James, and Ralph was blown away by them, Ralph Bass was. He offered them an immediate contract to come up to Cincinnati and record. There was a song on the demo that Ralph was particularly impressed by called Please, Please, Please. And that was the main song he wanted. So he went after him, heard him at a club in Macon, Georgia, and signed him on the spot, beating Chess Records to the punch.
And Please, Please, Please was the first record that James Brown released on the King label.
Yes.
And it was a big hit.
It was a big regional hit. It wasn't really a national hit, but it was a big enough hit that it got some national notice.
Now, the way you tell the story in the book, Sid Nathan, the owner of the label, the founder of the label, didn't like this record and didn't like the idea of releasing it.
He hated the record. He had several caustic comments about it and actually interrupted the recording studio, yelling at Ralph Bass that nobody wanted to hear this kind of music. And he threw a big tantrum, and Ralph Bass finally just challenged him and said, look, I know what this is. I know that I've got a hit here. You just put the record out in Atlanta, Georgia, and if it's not a hit there, I'll quit. I'll just quit. You don't have to fire me. I quit. Ralph was that sure of it. And that mollified Sid enough that he went back into the control room, and after everybody got their composure regained, they went ahead and recorded that song.
So did Sid Nathan, who didn't like this record very much and founded the record company, end up making peace with James Brown when he realized how popular and how lucrative it was to be affiliated with James Brown?
Theirs was an uneasy piece. They basically went through the same song and dance every record. James wanting to do what... James road tested his material before he recorded it. So he had a pretty good idea what was working at the band's appearances, what really shook up the audience and what they didn't care for. Sid, on the other hand, usually viewed all of James' ideas as terrible, and all of the music is just unreleasable. And they fought that battle, and James outsmarted him various ways, worked around him various ways. And the records were always successful, like the Live at the Apollo. James had to pay to record that himself. But then once Sid Nathan realized how good it was and what he had, he bought it from James.
Now, Sid Nathan eventually owned a piece of every aspect of the record business. Correct me if I'm wrong here. He had studios, he had a pressing plant, a distribution company, a trucking business. Am I missing anything?
Yeah, he actually made turntables for a while. They sold King.
Great.
Well, he didn't make them, but they sold King turntables, King record players.
So
you could actually get the whole thing under one roof.
I think we've probably done a better job in showcasing a little bit of the rhythm and blues that King recorded than the country. Would you choose one of your favorite country recordings that came out of King?
Blues Stay Away From Me by the Delmore Brothers.
And why are you choosing that?
Well, I think it's a great song, first of all. That's what Sid Nathan would want me to say. It's a great song that has stood the test of time. But it also, in one song recorded in one day at the recording studio in Cincinnati, it kind of demonstrates the King model at work. It was an in-studio collaboration between the two Delmore brothers, Alton and Rabin, who were from North Alabama, Wayne Rainey, a harmonica player from Arkansas. Those three were white from the South. And then Henry Glover, the producer of the song, the producer of the recording session and the co-writer of the song. The four of them in the studio worked up the song from ideas that Alton Delmore and Henry Glover brought to the table. And the entire process was an equal collaboration between those four men. And I think that that just kind of illustrates the way that King let their artist do what they wanted to do, but also helped introduce them to different things, like Sid Nathan wanting the Stanley Brothers to record Finger Poppin' Time, or wanting some of his other country artists to record these black songs that he, or these R&B and blues songs that he had the control of that he thought were good songs. This was just sort of, in one song, was the distillation of the King model at work.
Well, John Fox, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Terry.
John Hartley Fox is the author of the new book, King of the Queen City, The Story of King Records.